boredom. "What's up?"
For once, Kodak's easygoing expression was absent. Instead, he looked tired and grim.
"Thought you'd want to know. We lost Bingo day before yesterday."
Lost meant dead. Bingo was the nickname Kodak's team had given Brian Donnelly almost as soon as he joined the team.
"Shit,"
Levi said under his breath.
Losing any member of any team was always a kick in the gut. But Donnelly was not only one of the drone operators. He was Gina's friend.
That one time Levi had been around him, he'd had to like him, even though he'd been jealous as hell over Donnelly's status as Gina's date.
"What happened?" "Things went sideways," Kodak said wearily. "We were doing a hostile exfil. The LZ was hot, and Bingo took one in the head."
That was a very brief description, but Levi knew exactly what the exfil had been like, having done more than one himself. Chaotic, violent, bad shit going down. It happened. And now, he had to tell Gina. Even though she was tired and would have liked to sleep for half the day, Gina had already learned that the best way to get back on schedule was to stay awake for the rest of the day and do normal stuff. Besides, she didn't want to sleep just yet. The dead guy's face, even though he was a bad dead guy, wasn't far enough away from her subconscious. She didn't want him to bother her, but he still did. On the way home, she stopped at an IHOP and had breakfast, taking care to sit well away from other customers, because she figured she stank. If she did, at least the waitress didn't make a face. Coffee, bacon, and eggs went a long way toward making her feel human again. Gray daylight was peeling back the shadows of darkness as she drove the rest of the way home. When she unzipped her go bag to dig out the dirty laundry, however, the smell nearly knocked her down. Her head turned aside. She dumped all the contents out in front of the clothes washer. Whether she'd worn everything or not, all of it was contaminated beyond what she could bear. If the source of the extremely bad smell hadn't been her dirty socks, she'd have thought the guys had pranked her by maybe spraying the inside of her bag with sulfur mixed with skunk, and maybe dead possum thrown in for variety. Her Merrell sneaker smelled really bad too, though the footbed was supposed to have odor control. Maybe rainforest funk outstunk the control factor. She stripped off where she stood, determinedly ignored the blood on her jeans, and started her laundry, even tossing the sneakers in too. If being washed ruined them, then they were ruined. She could buy more sneakers, but she couldn't stand that smell. After that, she took a nice long shower, shampooing twice, conditioning, and sighing with relief because her skin could breathe again, without all the dirt and sweat. Doing girl stuff felt so good. She moisturized, put on scented body lotion, then pulled on a pair of cuddly flannel pants and a long-sleeved thermal shirt. She removed her chipped toenail polish and put on a pair of moisturizing socks to pamper her feet. There. Human again. She was on the couch catching up on some programs she'd recorded when the doorbell rang. She scowled at the door. No way should her doorbell be ringing, unless maybe the downstairs neighbor had a dead battery and needed their car jumped off. That was the only possibility that got her to her feet. But it wasn't either of her neighbors she saw through the peephole. It was Levi. "I don't need this," she thought. This wasn't how to keep his distance. She could get angry at him. She could sometimes hate him, but what she could never do was be indifferent to him. She needed his help. She needed him to stay away.
"Go away," she said aloud, leaning her head against the door. "It's important."
Of course it was. Damn. She unlocked the door and opened it, standing in the threshold so he couldn't come in.
"What?"
He came in anyway, simply stepping forward and putting his hand on the side of her waist, muscling her back, then closing the door behind him. Gina's heart tripped at his expression, both grim and remote. She knew he'd gone first to debriefing, but evidently he hadn't had an opportunity to shower and change clothes. He still wore the grimy clothes he'd had on when he drove away a few hours ago. He still had a 2-day stubble darkening his jaw. Whatever had happened was bad enough that he'd come straight here. Her thoughts flashed to her family. If anything had happened to one of them, was it somehow set up that Levi would be notified first if the team was on a mission? They weren't on a mission now, but they just returned, so that was possible. She hadn't checked her personal cell phone for messages or looked at Facebook. She had no idea what could have happened. She kept on moving back, putting distance between them. "What?" she asked again, but this time there was alarm in her voice, because she'd never seen him look like that.
"There's no easy way to tell you,"
he said, striding forward and gripping both her elbows before she could back even farther away.
"Babe, Donnelly got hit."
Hit could mean slapped. Hit could mean struck by a car. But in their world, hit meant something else entirely. She felt as if she'd been hit herself and would have reeled back if he hadn't been holding her, his big hands like clamps on her arms. His dark gaze was steady on her face, reading and assessing every thought and emotion that flickered past. She looked around, as if her condo could give her some safe, reassuring answer. Donnelly was her friend. Donnelly had the same job she did. They stayed out of the action, though hadn't she almost gotten hit herself about 15 hours ago? "Is he..." Her voice was faint and faded away. Her lips felt numb, barely able to move. She swallowed, tried again. She couldn't ask if he was dead, couldn't make herself say the word. Instead, she said, "Will he be all right?" Levi slowly shook his head. His voice was quiet.
"No."
She stood very still, staring at his chest, about 3 inches from her nose. She didn't want to look up into his eyes. She wanted to pull into herself and not move at all for a very long time, until she could process this and handle it, get her emotions under control. Donnelly was dead. Donnelly. He was a nice guy, everyone said, and he had been. Good-looking, good-humored, intelligent, friendly, sharp. What wasn't to like? She wished she could have loved him. Very gently, Levi eased her forward until she was resting against him and closed his arms around her. Gentleness from him was devastating. It shattered her self-control, allowed the grief to come roaring up. A sob caught in her throat, broke free, and she began crying. Levi pulled her even closer, his big hand coming up to cradle the back of her head, his strength wrapping around her as if giving her permission to turn to mush within that sturdy framework of protection. She still tried to resist, for maybe a second. Then she rested her forehead against the hard muscle of his chest, circled his waist with her arms, and gave in. Even when the sobs dwindled down to sniffles and trickles of tears, she stood there in the circle of his arms, tiredly astonished that he was holding her and just letting her cry. Because Levi didn't strike her as a man who was very patient with shows of emotion. The hand on the back of her head was slowly rubbing, his fingers sifting through her damp hair, his fingertips brushing the nape of her neck.
"Where were they?"
she finally asked, her voice nasally and thick with tears.
"I don't know. I can find out, but does it matter?"
She felt something brush the top of her head. Had he kissed her, or had he rubbed his chin against her hair? But as he'd said, did it matter?
"No,"
she said to both questions, and fell silent again. After a while, she withdrew her arms from around his waist and gently pulled back. His arms tightened briefly, then he released her and stepped back. She scrubbed her hands over her damp cheeks, wiped her eyes on the hem of her shirt.
"Have you had anything to eat?"
"Haven't had time."
Meaning he'd come straight here to give her the news before she could find out from someone else. She nodded and managed to look at him.
"Are you hungry?"
"As a bear."
A small quirk curled one corner of his mouth.
"Have you had that shoulder looked at?"
"Haven't had time."
Okay, that settled that.
He'd offered her comfort, likely against his better judgment, so she felt obligated to offer him something in return.
He was tired, he was hungry, he was hurt. She couldn't just push him out the door.
"If you want to grab a quick shower, I can have eggs and bacon on the plate by the time you're finished.
You'll likely need stitches, and I can't help with that, but I can put a clean bandage on your shoulder. She paused. And you'll have to put your dirty clothes back on, because I don't have anything that'll come close to fitting you, other than a sheet. He didn't say anything right away, making her brace herself for a rejection. He surprised her by finally saying,
Both the shower and food sound great. You don't mind me using your shower?
I wouldn't have offered if I did. I doubt you're dirtier than I was. The fresh towels and washcloths are in the linen closet in the bathroom. She showed him the way through her bedroom to the connecting bath. Once she'd have been embarrassed by her unmade bed, but he knew she'd jumped out of bed in the middle of the night, and his bed wasn't likely made either. How do you like your eggs?
In pancakes.
She snorted, but said, got it, and left him to it, hurried back to the kitchen. As it happened, she was short on eggs. She had one. But she did have a shaken pour pancake mix, and a couple of packs of pre-cooked bacon. She got out her griddle pan and began getting it hot while she nuked some of the bacon. Because she was smart that way, she also started some coffee brewing. Poor Donnelly. She tried to think of the last time she'd seen him. Maybe 2 weeks ago? They'd run into each other briefly, stopped to chat. Nothing special. He was enjoying being on Kodak's team. Some last meetings were a humdrum, completely forgettable. The same with last words. She couldn't remember what they'd said specifically. The last time you saw someone should be special, marked in your memory by a sense of importance. But no, she couldn't remember what they'd said. The dead guy in the jungle didn't seem nearly as important now. Someone very much like him had killed Donnelly. The sad realization that she'd never see him again settled inside her. If he'd quit, moved to a different part of the country, she wouldn't even have truly missed him. She'd have shrugged and moved on. Knowing that he was no longer alive was different, because he was truly gone. The part of the world that his soul and spirit had occupied was now empty. She had the first two pancakes plated and buttered when Levi came into the kitchen, dressed in the same pants and shoes, but bare-chested. She knew why. Putting that dirty shirt on over his uncovered wound wouldn't be smart. She wasn't in the mood to ogle his naked chest anyway, despite how impressive it was. The sadness in her filled up the space that was normally occupied by lust. She lifted her brows at him. Which do you want first, food or bandage?
Food,
he replied, no hesitation. She poured two more rounds of batter onto the griddle pan, then took the plate with the two pancakes to the table, along with a fork, the bottle of syrup, and the plate of bacon. Go ahead and get started. I'll bring these two when they're finished. Then she took a cup of coffee to him, not asking if he wanted sugar or creamer, because as far as she knew, all the team drank it black. They kept things simple.
Thanks,
Levi said, his gaze on the pancakes. She understood. She'd felt that way about her plate at IHOP earlier. He was taking the last bite of the first two when she brought the second two to him. Two more coming, she said. Tell me when you're finished.
Six should do it.
He was slower on the second two. There was still some left when she brought the last pair. She liked feeding him, she thought. She liked that he'd used her shower. If they were together, this was how it would be. Ah, well, no point in dreaming. After setting the plate down, she took the time to look at the wound on his back. The piece of wood had left a jagged puncture that would definitely need stitches. The wound was deep, the area around it swollen and discolored, red and deep purple. Hope you're up to date on your tetanus shot, she said. You should have had that wound taken care of before you came here. But I know why you did. Thank you. There was something of the predator in the fierce darkness of his gaze that slanted toward her.
I am. You're welcome.
While he was finishing, she fetched her first aid kit. Then he sat while she plastered an antiseptic pad over the wound and taped it. Afterward, he pulled on his dirty shirt, took his dirty plate and fork to the sink. She let him, though a proper hostess would have protested. She wasn't a proper hostess. She was a teammate, and teammates could take their own dirty plates to the sink.
Thanks for breakfast,
he said, turning toward her. His gaze flickered to her mouth, then his eyes shuddered. He turned and went to the door. When he reached it, he looked back at her.
I'm sorry about Donnelly. I'd tell you not to let it eat at you, but it will. It's eating at me, too. You drone operators are supposed to be in safe places, but the truth is, on a mission, there aren't any safe places.
No, there wasn't. After he left, silently closing the door behind him, she crossed the room and secured the locks. The irony wasn't lost on her. She could lock the door, but when it came down to it, Donnelly hadn't been safe. And neither was she. 18. In April, the South African banker, Graham Berger, cleared customs with his family, and for 4 days gave every appearance of being nothing other than a tourist, hitting all the usual historical sites in D.C. None of the GO teams were deployed to follow him. Axel McNamara preferred to keep a level of separation between his teams and any domestic issues. Let the FBI handle it. That way, any triumph was theirs, but so was any failure. Mac's policy was proved to be a smart choice. On the fifth day, Mr. Berger somehow managed to ditch his surveillance. In D.C., where cameras were everywhere, that was an impressive feat for even the most experienced agent. For a banker from a foreign country to do it, sent alarm flags flying at every intelligence agency in the federal government. He connected with his wife and children 4 hours later, smiling, and resumed doing touristy things. Joan Kingsley, alone in her big house, smiled too as she imagined all the intensifying interest being focused on Graham Berger. The banker was garnering all sorts of attention, and as of now, Axel McNamara would double down on his efforts to find out what was going on. The bastard always assumed the worst, assumed massive, complicated conspiracies were going on all around him. And sometimes he was right. Like now. Only national security wasn't the target this time. He was. She knew how it worked, because she'd seen the system in action so many times. Now Devon would begin feeding them bits of crucial information that would pull Ace Butcher's GO team into an ambush. The big step that would hook McNamara himself. She could hardly wait. July came in hot and humid. Gina realized it had been a little over a year since she'd begun training, but whoop-de-doo, something like that didn't call for a celebration. It was a guideline for marking time, nothing more. On one level, everything continued as normal. Another drone operator was being trained to join Kodak's team, and this time Kodak and the rest of his team were involved from the beginning. She thought that would become the accepted way of doing things from now on. Donnelly's death had brought it home to everyone that the drone operators were only as safe as the situation allowed them to be, and that the situation could change at the drop of a hat. What could be done to ensure their safety was already being done, and when it came down to it, it was the team operator's safety that was the most important, not the drone operators. As Levi had so pointedly told her on the first day of training, she was the least important member of the team. There was far more money and training invested in the guys, and their expertise was off the charts in comparison with hers. In the middle of July, they were notified of an upcoming mission into Syria. At the news, a heavy sense of dread settled in Gina's stomach. Syria was one of the most dangerous places on Earth. She was more politically aware now than she'd ever been before, and she knew Syria was a war zone. Government forces had lost control of most of the country. Battles continued with ISIS, and oh boy, did she not want to get in the middle of that. At least they didn't have to leave in the middle of the night. The mission required meticulous planning and timing, because of the uncertainty of the ground situation. They were to meet up with a Syrian sympathizer who would lead them to where an informant was hiding. Their mission was to get the informant safely out of Syria, because he wouldn't tell them what he knew until then. The first reaction had been to leave him there. If he wanted to play games when his own safety was ostensibly at risk, then his information likely wasn't that valuable. Then he'd mentioned a name that had gotten their attention. Graham Berger. What they knew about Graham Berger was getting murkier, rather than clearer. First, he had ties with the Sudanese Nawal Daw, and now his name was cropping up in Syria. Someone who had at first seemed to be low tier was assuming more and more prominence. His ties and influence were looking like a spider web, with far-reaching consequences. The world of terrorist groups was Byzantine. They were as often enemies with each other as they were with the Western governments. They were less effective because of that. No one wanted them to link together and begin working as a cohesive force. And it was beginning to look as if Graham Berger might be trying to do that very thing. Gina completely understood why they were going to Syria. What she hated was the how, because they had to parachute in. As soon as she heard the plan during their mission briefing, she got the familiar sick feeling. She'd done more jumps. She had to keep current with her training. But at best, she'd learned how to function. That was it. She dreaded each and every jump, was sick with nerves beforehand, panicked when she first left the plane, and her landings were clumsy at best. Usually she landed on her fourth point of contact, namely her butt. Still, she did it, and hated every second of it. Sitting in the briefing room, she could feel each team member giving her a quick, concerned glance, because they all knew how much she hated it, and because they were concerned. She had to do it. She couldn't let them down. They were lucky in that the new moon was in 36 hours, so at least they'd be jumping in the dark. It would have to be a high-altitude jump to evade radar. The region they were jumping into was sparsely populated. But the Russians had supplied the Syrians with mobile radar-slash-missile batteries that could be anywhere. Theoretically, the batteries were deployed near the ports, but theoretically was the key word. Parachute in, meet the sympathizer who would take them to the informant. Then they'd have to get out. That was the hard part. There would be 9 of them. A truck would be easier, stealthier, as long as they didn't encounter any ISIS forces. A helicopter would be faster, but would have to fly the nap of the earth to stay under the radar horizon, and would attract more attention. Neither option was great, in Gina's opinion. But the GO teams were built to take such difficulties in stride. Every operation had problems peculiar to it. And their job was to solve those problems and execute the mission. How they did it was up to them.
"Our LZ is here," Levi said,
pointing to a spot in the southern Syrian desert.
"Our contact will have a truck fueled and ready to go here."
He pointed to another location, about 2 kilometers from the LZ.
"Babe, there are some ruins where you'll set up. We'll collect our package, haul ass for Iraq, where we'll have transport home."
He paused.
"We're operating with one eye closed here, because we don't know exactly where the informers hold up. He could be close, he could be several clicks away, and we don't know in which direction. Regardless of where he is, if the situation goes tits up, our secondary exfil point will be here. A bird will come in low from Iraq and pick us up."
He gave the coordinates, and everyone made note. It was understood that, in the event they had to use the secondary point, it would likely be an emergency situation, and they wouldn't have the truck. They'd possibly be under hostile fire, double-timing it on foot across the desert in miserable heat, at night. For, Gina did some rough conversion of kilometers to miles in her head. Over 20 miles.
Closer to 25 miles, likely, which was almost a frickin' marathon.
If they were military, a helicopter would fly through hell to pick them up. But they weren't military, and they had to do the best they could while keeping as low a profile as possible. Summer. Desert. It was going to be hellishly hot.
"Go home. Get ready. Get some rest," Levi finished. "We leave at 0300.
Getting some rest sounded like a good idea. When Gina climbed the stairs to the small landing outside her door, though, a tall man was sitting on the floor against the wall and got to his feet as she approached.
"Taz!"
She gaped at him.
"What are you doing here? Why didn't you call?"
"Just passing through. Had some time to kill, thought I'd come see you,"
he said, which didn't at all explain why he hadn't called. She gave him a sisterly, get-real look. Just passing through? He was military. He didn't just pass through anywhere. He was in fatigues, and his camo duffel bag was at his feet.
"Where are you being deployed to?"
He shrugged, meaning he couldn't say. As she unlocked the door, Gina thought the military had been good for her little brother, giving focus to what had been a lot of energy and an inclination to try anything with the possibility of breaking his neck. He was a man now, not a boy. The staff sergeant's stripes on his sleeve said so. She eyed the stripes. When did you make E6? He'd been in E5 the last time she'd seen him at Christmas.
Couple of months ago.
He shut the door behind him.
When did you learn what the stripes mean?
Oops. Civilians without prior military service wouldn't recognize most ranks by the insignia. I live in D.C., she pointed out, thinking fast. You can't walk 10 steps without running into someone who's in the military. He gave her his own version of a get-real look.
Come on, sis, fess up. I'm not Mom and Dad. I know you aren't working on software.
His encompassing assessment started at her head and swept down to her feet.
What?
She looked down at herself. She was wearing a t-shirt, jeans, and her latest pair of sneakers, which in her view was pretty damn normal.
I do too work with software. Do you think I should have a pocket protector or something?
You look hard as a rock.
You were never as girly girl as Ashley and Callie, but you always had on some face stuff.
He circled his finger around his eyes.
Lipstick and shit. Not now, though. Yeah, running a lot will tone you up, but it won't give you those arms.
At least he hasn't mentioned that my boobs have gone away, too, she thought in exasperation.
I work out. I don't just run. My job is classified. I'll give you that. But do you know how many people in the area work on classified stuff?
She glanced at her phone, checked the time.
Do you have time for dinner?
I do. You cooking?
The get real expression came out again.
I'll treat you, as long as your taste runs to a pizza joint, or maybe Italian.
He hooked his arm around her shoulder.
Now you're talking.
Taz had 6 hours to kill before he had to report for duty, and seemed determined to spend every minute with her. Normally she'd have loved his company, but not when she needed to get her gear ready and get some sleep. She watched the clock the whole time they were at the pizza joint, mentally counting down how much sleep she could get. When he finally left at 8 p.m., she figured she was good for a solid 4, then more on the flight. She wanted those 4 hours, though, so she intended to zip through repacking her go bag. Then her phone rang. Her mom, who had just talked to Taz. Gina chatted while she packed, grabbing her boots because they were going to the desert, extra socks, a change of clothes, some wet wipes and sunscreen, lip balm, extra water, some protein bars and hard candy. By the time she got off the phone and got showered, she was a little short on those solid 4, but family. What could she do? She loved them anyway. About 8 hours into the flight the next day, Gina wasn't so certain about loving them. She'd slept, she'd read some in the book she'd brought along, and time was still dragging. There was nothing about a long flight that was enjoyable, even on a chartered jet. She changed out of her sneakers into her boots, and as soon as she shoved her foot into the first boot, she knew. Ah, crap. Completely disgusted with herself, she leaned her head back against the seat. Yes, Taz and her mom had distracted her, but bringing the right gear was her responsibility.
What's wrong?
Boom asked beside her.
I grabbed the wrong boots.
He opened both eyes, looked at them.
They look okay to me.
They don't fit as well as the others.
She scowled, dug an extra pair of socks out of the bag and put them on too.
When they got home, she'd drop these boots in a donation box, get them out of her closet so she didn't make the same mistake again. She'd already thought about doing so, but hadn't gotten around to it. Now she was stuck wearing boots that were too big. Well, she'd made it through weeks of training with them, so she supposed she'd live through a single mission wearing them. Lesson learned. Besides, if she could focus on fretting about the boots, maybe she wouldn't fret so much about jumping out of a plane, in the dark, into Syria. Nope. Needed something worse than the boots. Jumping from a high altitude required oxygen, Jumping at night required night vision goggles. Jumping at all required either nerves of steel or the brain of a hamster. Her nerves definitely weren't steel, so Gina figured her brain was rodent-like. The equipment bag went first, rigged for an automatic halo, so it would be on the ground waiting for them. Then, one by one, the guys went out of the lowered ramp, disappearing into the night. Gina was next to the last. She would have been last, but they never let her take that position because they weren't certain she'd actually jump if there wasn't someone behind her. Tonight, the last one was Snake. Tweety and the laptop were strapped to her back, along with her regular bag. She had her oxygen mask in place. She had her NVD, night vision device, on. She took a steadying breath, closed her eyes, and took a small leap into the night. The experience was still terrifying. The cold and the wind tore at her, almost pulled her oxygen mask off. With one hand, she secured it, reset the goggles, looked for the rest of the team. She couldn't see them. Wait, there was movement. She maintained her body position, monitored her altitude, kept an eye on the team member she could see. The only available ambient light was starlight, and the NVD turned everything green. But if she could see one, then she figured Snake, above her, could see her. That made her feel more secure, which was asinine when she was plummeting through nothing in the dark toward Earth. At the proper altitude, she deployed her chute. So prepared now for the violent jerk upward and the straps cutting into her legs that she barely noticed them, other than as a signal that everything was working as it should. Immediately, she looked around for the others so she could steer away from them. They were more visible now, the billowing parachutes like giant green mushrooms. She checked above her, located Snake. His chute had opened without problem, too. The arid air made for a slower descent, which extended the time they were sitting ducks for anyone with a firearm, and there was nothing they could do about it. Gina's nerves were in shreds by the time she saw the ground coming at her. She flared the chute, tried for the one-point landing, and as usual, failed miserably. She got off her butt and reeled her chute in, wadding it up and securing it.
Babe.
She turned toward the whisper and located Levi, joined up with him and Crutch. They went down on one knee to provide a smaller target. There was virtually no cover that she could see. There were some rocks, a few bushes, some dark slits in the ground that she assumed were wadis, but that was it. The others shortly joined them, all of them accounted for. Boom, the first on the ground, had located the equipment bag and their weapons were distributed. They moved as silently as possible toward the contact point, communicating by hand signals and whispered into their comm units. Even though it was night and a wind was blowing, the heat was oppressive. She was sweating within seconds. Thank God they'd be gone by daybreak. The crumbled ruin where she'd be stationed came into view. It had been... she couldn't tell what it had been. The ruin was too large to have been a hut. But what else could it have been, out here literally in the middle of nowhere? Why would a hut be here anyway? Behind the ruins was the dark gash of another wadi, so maybe at one time the place had been more habitable. Levi signaled everyone to take a knee. Then Trapper and Voodoo silently circled the crumbled pile. A truck was tucked into the shadows on the other side of the ruin, a beat-up Toyota pickup truck that was so covered in dust it blended in with the surroundings. Maybe it wouldn't collapse under the weight of 9 people. Trapper reappeared and gave a thumbs up. Levi rose to his feet, and the team fanned out behind him, approaching the ruin from the front, while Trapper and Voodoo covered the back. When he was closer, he crouched, picked up a rock, and tossed it into the ruin. 10 seconds later, a small figure appeared in the shattered doorway. He wore the traditional loose trousers and a shirt, his thick, untidy black hair blowing around his face. He looked about 12, though he was likely older. He gave a low, warbling whistle. Levi whistled in return, but none of them advanced any closer. The boy stepped out of the doorway and waved his arm. He wasn't carrying any weapons, at least none that they could see. Cautiously, the team approached. Per Levi's instructions, Gina stayed at the back of the group and kept her jump helmet on, though her hair was plastered with sweat under it. With all the gear she was wearing, no one would make her as female, as long as her head was covered, and she wore the NVD.
"I am Mamoon,"
the boy said when they got close enough to hear him, his English understandable. He had a quick, shy grin, though it faded somewhat when he looked up at Levi, towering over him.
"You are here to pick up a package, yes?"
"Yes," Levi affirmed. "A large package."
Mamoon's grin flashed again, perhaps at the description.
"Very good,"
he said happily. Behind him, a man appeared out of the shadows, and every weapon came up. Mamoon's eyes got big, and he stepped back, raising one hand.
"This is my uncle, Yasser. He will take you to the package."
"We were to meet one person,"
Levi said, his tone hard.
"I am Mamoon's only relative,"
Yasser said with dignity. Like Mamoon, his English was more than passable.
"He lives with me. This is your home?"
Yasser looked around at the crumbling ruin.
"No, of course not. Please to enter."
Jelly slipped past them, sliding along the perimeter of the remaining walls. Only when he reappeared, signaling the okay, did Levi, Boom, and Gina enter. They pulled down their NVDs, and Levi shone a narrow penlight around the interior, examining it. Over half of the exterior walls were down, and most of the interior ones. But at the very back of the rough structure was a small room that was mostly intact. A black curtain of some thick, rough material closed it off. The heat inside the stone walls was somewhat less, but still stifling.
"Here,"
Gina murmured, knowing her raspy voice would help disguise her sex. She didn't want to run afoul of any cultural differences, but at the same time, she was here to do her job. If she could do it without stirring up any trouble, fine. The black curtain would block out the light from the laptop screen, giving her a measure of cover while she worked. At the same time, she would pretty much be trapped in the rear of the ruin, with only one way out. Levi said quietly,
"Get set up."
He ducked back through the black curtain, letting it fall, and began talking to Yasser. Their voices faded away as they walked toward the front of the ruin. Gina put the equipment bag down and took out her own penlight to better explore her surroundings. The little room, no more than 8 feet wide, wasn't completely solid. At the back, the wall on the left had partially collapsed. She could feel air moving, and when she got down on her hands and knees to look for the source of the breeze, she could see a deeper darkness. She moved a couple of pieces of rubble and saw a jagged hole at the base of the wall, too small for a man to fit through. Mamoon, perhaps, could do so. And she thought she could, too. She felt slightly better. This whole situation made her uneasy. Everyone was uneasy, and with good reason. The least hiccup could spell disaster. 19.
Levi said, "How far away is the package?"
"Far enough to feel safe,"
Yasser answered dryly. His eyes weren't friendly, but Levi didn't expect friendliness, just cooperation. Many moderate Arabs didn't care for Westerners, but cared even less for radicals or their own governments. For his part, Levi wasn't concerned with whether or not Yasser was sympathetic. All he wanted was cooperation.
"I need a time frame."
Yasser shrugged.
15 minutes.
"About a mile, then. Well within Tweety's range." Levi looked around. He didn't like leaving Babe here, but the whole point of her job was to squat in a safe location and keep an extra eye out for the rest of the team. Taking her with them defeated the purpose, because she couldn't walk and operate the drone at the same time. That left him with a choice to make: split the team and leave a couple of guys here with Babe, or take them all with him to maximize the odds of mission success. His training said mission success was the most important. If the informant was so afraid that he was hiding even from his rescuers, then he likely had reason to be, which meant there could well be others out there looking for him. This could still turn out to be a simple retrieve and go, but experience told him otherwise.
"I'm leaving one of my team members here," he said. to handle communications.
That was true, as far as it went. He wasn't telling anyone about Tweety, and it would be up to Babe to deploy the drone unnoticed. She likely already had. Looking around, he could see Boom and Jelly kidding around with Mamoon, which meant she was alone in the ruin, doing her thing. The little drone was virtually silent, and wouldn't be noticed at night.
Ah, said Yasser. I see. That is good. I will be able to leave Mamoon with him then. I did not want to take the child, because there could be danger, but did not like to leave him here alone.
Levi nodded an affirmative. He liked the idea. That way Babe wouldn't be by herself. The kid seemed bright and friendly, and spoke English as well as his uncle. He said,
I'll have a word and be right back.
And entered the ruin to talk to Babe, picking his way through the rubble. She looked up as he pulled aside the black curtain and stopped beside her. She'd already had the laptop booted up, as he'd expected. She'd made a mostly level place on top of the half-collapsed wall, where she'd set the laptop and stood in front of it, tapping on the keys. The illumination of the screen was the only light, giving her a ghoulish look. She'd removed her jump helmet, but even so her hair was dark with sweat, and her skin was shiny with it. He liked the look on her, but then he liked how she looked regardless. Smart girl. She'd taken her pistol out of the holster and placed it by her hand, saving her a second of time if she needed it. She glanced up at him, then back at the screen. Yeah? She never maintained eye contact for longer than she had to. He understood that boundary, respected it. He'd love to smash it to pieces, but he respected it. For now. How long that would hold true was anyone's guess.
The kid is going to stay here with you, so you aren't alone.
Fine. Another quick glance. Not necessary, though. I've been alone before.
This could get hairy. You gotta figure the informer has someone hot on his ass, or he wouldn't be so jumpy. There's no telling what we might run into out there, retrieving him. And that's assuming he doesn't get cold feet and rabbit on us.
Nothing we can do about that. He's either there or he isn't. And if anyone is out there, Tweety will see them. He looked at the screen. As he'd figured, Tweety was in the air. She had the drone hovering silently over the ruin, slowly rotating as she checked on each teammate, one by one.
Yasser and Mamoon were standing together, Yasser's hand on the kid's shoulder.
They appeared to be having an earnest conversation, the kid nodding his head as he got his instructions. Be careful, she said. For a second, their eyes met. Then she looked down again before he could get a read on anything, given the dimness of the light.
You too, babe, he said,
knowing she wouldn't hear the faint difference in how he said the word, without capitalization. His palm tingled. The impulse to smooth his hand over the back of her head, her neck, was so strong he could actually feel the sensation, even though he wasn't touching her. Aw, shit. He needed to get his head off this dead-end path and back on the job. He ducked through the curtain and back outside, though inside was a loose description to use for a structure that was mostly in ruins.
Lead the way,
he said briefly to Yasser. Yasser pulled a fold of his headdress across his nose and mouth to filter out the dust blown by the hot wind. Levi and the rest of the team pulled their balaclavas up over the lower half of their faces for the same reason. With their NVDs in place, their faces were almost wholly obscured. The direction Yasser chose was north-northeast, toward rougher terrain. But that was a logical position for the informer, because it offered more concealment. A mile there, make contact, a mile back. Babe would be alone for no more than 45 minutes, if everything went smoothly. But there were no guarantees. Shit happening was such a given that Levi planned for it. The only unknown was what shape the shit would take. Gina took Tweety in slow circles around the fanned-out line of men, looking in all directions. She spotted the gazelle once, standing motionless and watching the humans pass by. She'd done her homework and knew there were gazelles and jackals and other mammals in the desert. There were also, surprisingly, scraggly shrubs and small trees, rock piles, jagged and barren mountains, and lots of flat space. Bedouins roamed the region, though in the heat of July it made sense that they were likely closer to water sources than they would be during the winter months. She wouldn't mind a little winter right now, or even a water source she could be close to. Sweat was dripping off her. But which was worse? Cold misery or hot misery? Hot misery, she decided, because she felt as if she could barely breathe. The hot wind kept the dust and sand stirred up, getting in every crevice, making her eyes and mouth feel gritty, her nose clogged. None of it was a happy feeling. She watched the screen, controlling Tweety with both keystrokes, to bring up his various cameras and the mini rollerball mouse that ruled the drone's movements, which she had attached to the laptop. Her communications headset was in place, earbud and throat mic, her NVD, equipment and gear bags, pistol and jump helmet right beside her, so she could grab and go if necessary. For the most part, the guys were silent, communicating by gesture or low-pitched comments when necessary. She too was quiet, because she had nothing to report. Idle chatter was distracting. She heard Mamoon enter the outer part of the ruin, moving around, singing a little under his breath. He'd been outside for a while, which suited her fine. If he was like most kids, her solitude back here wouldn't last long, because his curiosity would get the better of him. No sooner had she had the thought than the black curtain moved, and he slid behind it to join her in the small room. He stared at her in shock.
"You are a woman!"
She nodded, maintaining communication silence, keeping an eye on the screen. She feathered the rollerball, turning Tweety in a slow circle.
"You travel with men?"
His tone was scandalized. Gina clicked off her communications mic and indicated the pistol by her hand, though she kept watching the screen. "I'm armed," she said briefly. "They leave me alone." There was no point in getting into any long discussion about anything. Just let him know how such a thing was possible, then get back to her job. She clicked the mic back on. He watched her for a minute, her nimble hands in the fingerless black gloves, moving over the keys, fuzzing the trackball in minute adjustments. He looked at the screen, tilted his head a little, watched the view change as she surveyed the surroundings. The thermal imaging picked up a very small signature, and she zeroed in, enlarged, found some kind of weird rodent going about its ratty business. It looked like a mashup of rabbit, rat, and kangaroo. Backing out again, she resumed her area surveillance. Mamoon gasped as the line of men came on screen.
"How are you doing this?"
Crap. She wished he'd shut up and let her do her job. She clicked off the mic again. "I have a flying camera I'm controlling." His eyes got big, and he looked back at the screen.
"You saw the jerboa?"
"The rat?" "Yes, the camera is very sensitive." Mic back on. She moved Tweety to the other side of the team, searching, watching. She tried not to sound as impatient as she felt. Just kept it businesslike. But the kid must have picked up on something in her tone, because abruptly he darted back through the curtain and left her alone. Maybe he remembered something he was supposed to be doing. Maybe he was going to get something. Definitely he was a kid, so who knew? She was just glad he was gone, so she could concentrate. Checking the time, she saw that the men had been moving for 12 minutes. They should be getting close to where the informant was hiding. She wondered if there were any caves. There were jagged and rocky mountains and such, so logically there had to be caves. It was time to take Tweety farther in advance, see what he could see. Mamoon had gone outside the ruin. She could hear a faint, thunking sound to the left, as if he were fooling around the truck, maybe getting inside and pretending to drive. Maybe he already knew how to drive. Maybe he was getting in it to take a nap, out of the blowing sand, though she thought the interior of the truck would be too hot for comfort. She focused on Tweety, taking the little drone ahead, looking for the heat signature of the informant. She heard something else outside. A voice. A man's voice, hushed, too indistinct for her to make out words. At first she couldn't tell if she was hearing it in her earbud or in her uncovered right ear. She frowned, concentrated, listened. Then she heard Mamoon's lighter tones, as hushed as the other. Someone was out there. someone they hadn't expected. Had Mamoon heard him, gone out to deflect attention? No, it was the middle of the night, and they were in the freaking desert. People didn't just wander around and visit, especially not visit a ruin where no one was likely to be anyway. Whoever was there wasn't there by accident. Alarm tingled her spine. She started to let the team know she had company when Tweety's cameras picked up a thermal signature. A man-sized one. Then another, and more, easily 10 or 15, concealed on either side of the route the team would take. She forgot about the threat outside the ruin, focusing entirely on her guys. "Ambush! Ambush!" she said urgently. There was no time for anything else. As she got the second word out, a thunderous explosion sent rock and dust flying through the ruin, the percussion knocking her to the right. Her head and right elbow banged painfully against the wall, and she went down in a heap, with debris raining down on her. Coughing violently, dazed, she nevertheless did what her training had taught her to do, and pushed the debris away, immediately scrambled back to her feet. The darkness was absolute, the computer screen gone black. Assume the worst. The guys were too far away. Whatever attack was happening, she had to save herself. She couldn't see. Her night vision goggles, they'd been beside her, and were now God only knew where. She couldn't find anything. Blindly, she groped, touched something warm and metal, recognized the smooth edges of the laptop. The laptop was made to withstand being dropped, submerged, and any number of other insults to the sensitive workings. She had to assume it was still operable, which meant she couldn't let it fall into anyone else's hands. She couldn't hear anything. Her ears were ringing from the explosion. She couldn't tell if whoever had been outside was even now coming through the ruin in search of her. Assume the worst. She had to destroy the laptop. That had been drilled into her over and over, into all of the drone operators. The software was highly classified and could not be allowed to fall into anyone else's hands. Before she did anything else, even before she tried to save herself, she had to do her job and destroy the laptop. Feeling along the edge, she located the switch on the upper left of the casing and toggled it down. There was a bright, brief flash as the hard drive was destroyed. She had to trust that the destruction was complete because she had no way of checking. Now she needed to save herself. Her scrabbling fingers couldn't locate her bag, the NVD, anything. Ahead, a flashlight beam, two beams, were slashing through the dust and smoke. She couldn't go out that way, couldn't hear if they were talking, if they thought she was dead and were looking for a body, or if they assumed she'd lived through the destruction and was waiting for them, possibly injured, but definitely armed. Armed. Her pistol had been lying beside her. Now it was God knows where, and she didn't have the time to feel around for it. The hole, the one she'd located in the back wall, that was her only chance. Her gut instinct to not be trapped in the back with no escape had been completely on point. A flashlight beam flashed too close, and quickly she ducked to the floor. She had seconds, literally less than a minute, before they would be back here, unless by some miracle she found her pistol and shot in their direction. She wasn't waiting for that miracle. She had to move, and move now. She half-crawled, half-slithered back into the left, holding her breath so she wouldn't cough and give away her position, assuming the people searching for her could hear better than she could. She reached the back of the ruin, couldn't go any farther. She scrabbled around, searching for the opening, and finally found the partially blocked hole. More stones had fallen, slowing her down. She shoved some rock out of the way, got down on her belly, tried to wiggle through. The stones scraped on her arms, caught on her shoulders. No. Desperately, she turned on her side, worked her head through, pulled with her hands, pushed with her feet, and her shoulders were free. She was half in, half out, completely helpless if anyone saw her. She sucked in a breath, and dust clogged her nostrils, her throat. Quickly, she covered her mouth with both hands and tried to muffle the harsh cough she couldn't stifle. Out. She had to get out. She pushed some more, got her hips free and pulled her legs out. Quickly she turned, on her belly, and reached back through the wall. Pulled some debris back in place to hide the hole. Maybe that would buy her some time before they realized she'd escaped, rather than being buried under the rubble. Staying flat, she belly-crawled to where she remembered the Wadi being. Though she couldn't see a damn thing and could only pray she was going in the correct direction. The ground fell out from under her and she slid into the Wadi, rocks and sand going with her. Found it. She had to move. She couldn't stop and assess the situation until she was in a safer location. All they, whoever they were, had to do was walk to the edge of the Wadi and shine one of those flashlights down, and they'd see her. Her heart was pounding so hard she could feel her fingertips throbbing. She knew what direction the team had gone in, but when she thought about what she'd seen through Tweety's cameras, she remembered that the Wadi went roughly left to right, not on the diagonal she wanted. But it wasn't as if she had another to select. She had to go with the Wadi she had. She chose to go right, stumbling along the rough bottom, tripping over rocks, falling again. Shit. The delay and possible noise dismayed her more than any pain she might have felt if she'd thought about it. On her feet. Move. Keep moving. Her eyesight was adjusting, clearing, now that she was away from the smoke and dust. She could see deeper shadows, tell that the Wadi curved back to the left, taking her more in the direction she wanted, and the curve effectively hiding her from anyone still at the ruin. She stumbled along, unable to run because the bottom of the Wadi was so rough, but at least she was moving. She realized there was light, a strange light with an odd flicker to it. She glanced back and saw the night sky lit by the red, pulsing glow of fire, at least 100 yards behind her. Whatever had exploded was now burning. What?
Couldn't be the ruin. Stone neither exploded, on its own anyway, nor burned.
The truck. Had to be. There was nothing else there. The pieces fell into place. Mamoon. He'd been talking to someone, the little bastard. He and his uncle, if Yasser was indeed his uncle, were part of the ambush. When he'd seen on the laptop that she was surveilling the area ahead of the team, and that she could see them in the dark, he left immediately, likely to warn the others. Then whoever he'd told had faced the problem of both alerting the ambush waiting and preventing her from giving the alarm to the team. He'd failed in the last, but succeeded in the first. Levi. The team. The ringing in her ears was fading a little, enough that she could hear rapid, muted sounds. It took her a few seconds to identify gunfire, but where? Blindly, she spun in a circle, oriented herself by the glow from the fire, focused in on the distorted sound. There. Yes, the gunfire was coming from the direction of the team. Her stomach clenched. At least she'd been able to give them warning. Her headset had been knocked askew, but was still around her neck. She fumbled for the earbud, put it in place. Through the ringing in her ears, she could hear disjointed curses, grunts, the cracks and booms of gunfire, but she couldn't distinguish individual voices. She started walking again. Her headset was out of place, wrenched sideways by the explosion, or when she'd pushed herself through the jagged hole. The strap was twisted, the throat mic. Her fingers ran over it. The mic was damaged. She could tell just by touch. Shit. Shit. She couldn't make radio contact with the guys. She tried anyway, clicking on the mic. No, the mic had been on. She'd at least gotten out a warning about the ambush, so she had just turned it off. She clicked again, opened her mouth, then shut it. Anything she said right now, assuming her mic worked, would be a distraction. The Wadi turned sharply to the right, once more taking her away from their direction. She didn't dare climb out of it, not yet. She wasn't far enough away from the ruin, and they were in the middle of a firefight. She couldn't get to them. Sick with worry, she continued cautiously following the Wadi. In some places, the dry creek bed was shallow enough that she could see around her, plainly see the blaze in the distance, though it was beginning to die down. She had to bend double to not offer a silhouette, in case Mamoon or the men, with him, was scanning the area with night vision goggles. An MVD had fairly limited range of vision, and she thought she might be beyond that now, but she wasn't certain. The Wadi continued to bear to the right. If she continued following it, it would take her farther and farther from the team.